Number 2B.
So we hear now that Mrs. Eddy felt I must make that clear-cut distinction between metaphysics and mesmerism. It is also interesting to see that she capitalized at that time metaphysics, and she hadn't at that time capitalized science. So at that point, she didn't give so much value to science as she did give on metaphysics, or else she would have capitalized science and not metaphysics, which indicates that she still was in that mental era where she felt everything is mental and has to do with that which is above really the physical, namely the metaphysical, and therefore she capitalized metaphysics, whereas science was not capitalized. Then she said, what has really happened with the students? They were making the mistake of confounding really mesmerism with metaphysics, because mesmerism had nothing to do with the physical. It was a mental method. You see, Quimby and so on introduced the mental method of healing, and therefore it was metaphysical, and that's the true sense of it. That which is above physics is metaphysics. And so she was seeing that she must make a distinction between that mental teaching which she gave, which is metaphysics, and the mental method of healing which the mesmerist used. So all through that second edition, it's constantly comparing metaphysics with mesmerism. So she said, well, here we have the criteria for it, namely the moment I leave the field of metaphysics, I drop into mentalism, into mesmerism, and so this mentalism must be exposed. And again she asked that the community should be informed, that they should know that this is an outlaw, and therefore must be exposed. She was in a terrific situation, naturally. Here she was introducing a new way of healing that was not material, but mental, and then the students were misusing it, and therefore the community attacked Mrs. Eddy for teaching something which is bad, which is evil. They said, look here, what these students do, they have gone through the teaching of Mrs. Eddy, and so they were really saying Mrs. Eddy is at fault, and so all through that book, that chapter, she defends herself and says that metaphysics cannot be held responsible for malpractice because these are two very different and opposite fields. Quite to the contrary, she said, it is now metaphysics that can uncover really malpractice. So now she found a way how to find out those silent methods of malpractice, find out who does malpractice, because she said, I have now in my hands another weapon, namely metaphysics, which we will call today divine mind reading. That through divine mind reading, we really can, through the law of opposites, uncover that which is hidden away. We have seen that in the fourth chapter, that with divine mind reading, we can read the past, we can read distant thought, we can read near thought, we can read what was going on in the field of in the unconscious field, in the subconscious field of thought. She says and gives a date and said, it was actually in the year 1878 that she found out how malpractice can be unearthed by metaphysics, so that nothing is anymore hidden to the metaphysician. Sorry. And so introduces the divine mind reading at that point. and says, this is something very different. Don't mix it up again with the very opposite, with clairvoyance. Clairvoyance is the reading of beliefs, whereas divine mind reading is the reading of the divine mind, which can cover, through the law of opposites, the realm of beliefs. So that, she states, that not the person really is the culprit and the criminal. She says, mind, not matter, is the criminal. And that's how she concludes that whole dissertation on sorting out things in her mind so that metaphysics and mesmerism is not understood to be the very same thing, though both fields have to do with the mental. So that was the first introduction now, how to sort out the mental into a spiritual mental and into a material mental field of thought. Yes, that brings us to the third edition. And it is interesting to see that with every edition at the beginning, the text grows and grows. First, in the first edition, she only used a few pages. Then in the second edition, she already had, I don't know it right away, she had about 12 or 16 pages. But in the third edition, she had a treatise of 46 pages. And those 46 pages read like a detective story. And that's, I guess, the reason why she could sell with the third edition within a short time, within 2 or 3 years, she could sell three editions right away. And people were so attracted by this chapter, which now she called Demonology. So the first edition had no chapter title, the second edition had then Mesmerism, and now it comes even out worse, namely Demonology, which is actually the very opposite of soul, as you can feel, that soul is sinless, whereas the devil is the very opposite of the sinlessness of soul. And actually, when I read this edition, I made the discovery that is really what still, after how many years, after 50 years, I heard in the church about animal magnetism. These, what I'm going to show you or tell you, were those stories that were handed down, so to say, through many decades from generation to generation, because it's a very attractive detective story. What was the main points in it? The main point was to bring out really the demonology in the human character, namely the Judas character of the malpractitioner. She gives here a characteristic of Judas as the aggressive form of demonology, as exercise of despotic control, as abusing mental power. And you just can see what she means by it, and that the malpractitioner is a moral leper, he called them. She uses very strong language at that point. And she said, what are really the evil results that come out from such malicious malpractice? She says, well, you will find out that if such a malicious malpractice is practiced on the patients or the students, that then suddenly friends become enemies. They are turned right upside down. They change their character by 180 degrees. That friends become enemies. That family are set against each other. That the affections are alienated. That they turn against their benefactors. Instead of being grateful for the practitioner, they turn against the practitioner. And she said, what are really the indications that such a demonological method is at work? And she said, you can see the symptoms. The symptoms are that it sours the dispositions of the patient. It excites the passions and appetites. It induces disease and brings back old complaints. Relapse, for instance, is a typical symbol of animal magnetism. That it scares and tortures the minds, that suddenly they go off their minds. That it produces hatred where there was love. That it causes the patient to believe a lie, so that they could be inoculated with error, so that they mistook, really, error for truth, and believed that error was truth. So these are the things that we still hear in the church, don't you? That we still hear what animal magnetism can do, yes. But when we then take the final edition, there is practically nothing in it of all that story. Practically nothing. Just here and there an indication in the third subject. Again, she asks herself, how can we guard against becoming demonic practitioners ourselves? What is our protection that unwittingly, unknowingly, we become also malpractitioners? And again, she says, well, the only protection is really that we investigate true metaphysics, the science of life. Namely, first, that we investigate and have a knowledge of the mesmeric cause, that we don't shut our eyes to it, but investigate what is the cause of mesmerism, that we try to get a metaphysical understanding, not the mesmeric understanding, that we should never, that's a very interesting, never encroach on the rights of mind, that we should never enter really the thoughts of other people. And we do that. We are apt to do that. That we are thinking what the other body, what the other one is thinking, or what the other one should think, and how he should think. We enter into the consciousness of other people. This is malpractice. We do not enter the house of somebody without being invited to enter. We would never do that. We would never enter the house and deposit there all the garbage we know, we have, and say, here you have it. But we do that mentally. Mentally, we trespass on the privacy of the mentality of the other fellow. We put into his mental home all the garbage which we think about him and the garbage we think about us. We deposit all the mental garbage to somebody else. And he has to listen to us. So this is all malpractice. And so he said, never do that, never encroach on the rights of mind, never to infringe on the privacy of thought. Do we do that? And suddenly we begin to realize that we are falling quite a bit from a high standard of the one mind and feel we have the right to infringe on the privacy of other people's thought, to inquire what they are thinking, what they are doing, to squeeze them out to the last drop like a lemon until we know what is in their mind, what are their motives, what they are thinking, what they are doing, and so on. This is malpractice. We have nothing to do in other people's mind, just as we have nothing to do in other people's homes if we are not invited to. If the patient invites the practitioner to help him, he invites that he can come and bring his one mind, his divine mind, into his consciousness. But he invites it. But otherwise we have no right constantly, constantly to inquire what the other one is doing and trying to find out through secret ways and means what the other one is thinking and so on. This is malpractice. We trespass on other people's mind. That's mesmerism. That was her definition in the first place about mesmerism. Then she brings up another question and says, now, what is actually demonology as such? What is the nature of demonology? From where does demonology take its essence, its nature? As it says, it comes from sensuality, from envy, from malice, from hatred and revenge, cooperating in the individual mind. So the malpractice is that demonology is that we bring all the qualities of depravity into the minds of the student, into the mind of the patient, into the minds of our neighbor, into the minds of our friends. That's malpractice. So she says, in the year 1880, that was another 2 years, she really gives the dates when she was discovering really the workings of animal magnetism. So that was 1880. That was 14 years after her discovery of Christian Science. We can see that Mrs. Eddy underwent a terrific, great spiritual development. And I bring that out because I need that point for the whole of the rest of this week. Because one has that childish belief that in the year 1866, Mrs. Eddy discovered Christian Science, and that that was a revelation, and that in that revelation, really, everything was revealed to her. Not at all. It was only a breaking in of a terrific light, the effulgence of light, she said. But then afterwards, she had to work it out step by step, every detail, she had to work it out. And it took her a lifetime to work it out. Or else she wouldn't have changed the textbook over and over and over until the last year. She changed it again. Even in 1910, she made the last changes. So we must see that Mrs. Eddy underwent a spiritual development. And if Mrs. Eddy underwent a spiritual development, we know that there is only one spiritual evolution, the evolution of the world order. And therefore, every one of us undergoes the same evolution, the world order. Therefore, what I'm telling here is not history alone. It's history, but it's fundamental history. It's the history of every one of us. And I think when we get a good insight into this chapter, we find out that actually this is the way that we begin to see the nature of animal magnetism and uncover right down to the depths what animal magnetism really is, what its purpose is, how it works, and what it wants to accomplish. So she says in 1880 that for the first time she began to see really that her metaphysics, which she was teaching, was the metaphysics of mind, capital M. And from this time on, for the first time, she capitalizes mind in the chapter on animal magnetism. She had in other chapters from time to time, also in earlier editions, capitalized mind, but very seldom. But in the chapter, in the most important chapter, that on animal magnetism, up to that point, she never capitalized mind when she meant the divine mind. And you can see how that brought forth a lot of irritation, a lot of misunderstanding. So that she could say that the immortal mind, now capitalized, is not the same as the fables of mortal mind. Now she, you see, soul now defines properly. So now she defines what kind of mind she means when she talks about mind, either as human mind, mortal mind, or on the other side, as divine mind. Yes, she takes up another question. She says, even the good that the mesmerist does is bad. Another big insight she has won. Because the good he does is bad because he employs one belief to destroy another belief. And you can only destroy another belief by a stronger belief. So the good he does, say the healing he does through mortal mind, is even making the case worse, because then it is a healing of mortal mind or of willpower, and therefore the patient is left worse than before. So she says the good that the mesmerist does in his healing is actually doing something much worse, and brings about a situation that is much worse. His healing is what? It is the bigger error healing the lesser error, leaving the case worse. Again, we can see how she had to see through that hidden way, so that one couldn't say, but that mesmerist did heal this and this case, so he must have a good method. See, that's a wrong reasoning, but a very humanly logic reasoning. That, well, a healing is something good. Who doesn't want to have a healing? So if somebody brings about the healing, that's good. Well, today we know that everybody can bring about the healing through any of those 100,000 different methods of mental method. Can you change symptoms? That's today no more a big deal. You can do it with any belief system. But do we gain anything? If we can exchange one belief for a stronger belief, well, then we are worse off from the point of view of the divine mind. And that is what was of any interest to Mrs. Eddy. Can we bring about a healing that is positive, that is good, in so far that it brings the patient spiritually further, and not just change the symptoms on his body? The doctors do that very well. The doctors do that very well. They change the symptoms, and usually much quicker than the Christian Science practitioner, usually, in most cases, yes? And that we have to see. She began to see that and said, golly, 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 we have to see something about the quality of healing and not about the symptoms of healing. We have to see the quality. Is it something that is goes on in the realm of the divine mind, or is it something that goes on in the realm of the human mind? That's important. So another point she takes up and says, well, but demonology has also a strong point. There is nothing so bad that it has not a good side, namely that it forces really mankind to take refuge in metaphysics, so that the experiences that we make under the impact of animal magnetism, and especially on the malicious animal magnetism, said, how else can I protect myself? What shall I do in order not to come under that curse, that I'm not affected by it? And she said, there is only one way out, and that's metaphysics. And from that point on, she begins to speak about spiritual science and capitalizes science from that point on, and decapitalizes metaphysics. So we have a great change there in that third edition, that she began to see that we can only sanction that which is in the science of mind and comes from the science of mind, both science capitalized and mind capitalized, and metaphysics decapitalized. So that she could show all the mental ways, method of healing are actually making the case worse, and that only the divine mind method of healing resting on science can make a case better. And that's the reason why a Christian Scientist so often refuses to take a medical help, because he sees he doesn't gain anything except that the symptoms change. But he doesn't gain anything in the spiritual line. And so he tries his best to evade, if possible, another method, because he knows he has to work out his spiritual life and not a healthy body. That's the reason why we may not take refuge so quickly in another material method. So, she says, here we have it, that demonology is actually the activity of sin, depraved qualities in the human. It's not just a mental thought transference. Behind the mental state of a malpractitioner lies the whole character, the whole immorality of a practitioner, the whole sensuality, depravity of a practitioner. It's not just the transference of thought to another one that is at stake, but the whole sinful character and attitude of the practitioner which can only have a malicious effect on the patient and on the surrounding. Yes, that's the third edition, and you can see it has all to do with the main point of sin versus sinlessness. So, okay, tonight we have another hour at 7:30, and we take the other editions.